is shaking some people up down in Puerto Rico and other places. We'll see what happens there. And do we have Professor Kevin?
No, not yet.
Well, he should be on at some point here. What interesting bounce here in this Bitcoin. I think people are still coming up with new cryptocurrencies, which is...
every day.
And I don't know what... I mean, obviously, I give the Bitcoin number every morning because it's been kind of... But there's a whole bunch more of these things. I don't know what... I honestly have no clue is what you do with a Solana or a Dogecoin or an XRP. And one of the listeners told me yesterday that they're putting one together down in Texas. And it's, you know, there's a...
The Abbott coin? The Abbott coin. You know,
no, this is called...
Yeah, Governor Abbott down there.
It's called Texas coin or something.
Ah.
I don't know what... Now that we have some, I guess I can't explain why we have some. I don't know why you would need more, but maybe this is just a blank I have here. Just a blank. What do you think? Just a blank?
I think so. I mean, the hot new is the stable coin. It's backed against something. It could be backed against...
Well, I think if they're tied against tied to the dollar, which kind of leads you... The whole purpose is kind of... What's the purpose then?
Well, you know, the administration's big push. We're buying Bit, and we're... pushing it in, and
yeah, well,
we have Mr. O'Neill on the line.
Professor, how are you?
Good morning.
Are you back home?
Yes, I'm back home. A late basketball game last night.
You were 9 o'clock your time. The game started, right?
9 o'clock. 9 o'clock basketball game. Yep.
You were there by yourself. I watched the game. I didn't see anybody else.
Well, you know, it was a sparse crowd, but. But what do you expect at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night and when it's 20 degrees outside and snow's piled up everywhere? Damn!
Well, but who
bad scheduling?
Who makes that call? Was that a 9 o'clock game 6 months ago, or is this?
Yeah, it probably was as soon as it got scheduled. This is part of the ACC-SEC challenge, so it's all lined up for TV.
Oh, okay.
There's early games and there's late games, and. And remember, they're playing Missouri, so Missouri would be in the central time zone, so it's only 8 o'clock there.
8 o'clock's still pretty late.
Well, it is, but it wasn't so late that my brother and my nephew didn't come over for the game.
Well,
my nephew's a Missouri graduate, so we called him up a month ago and said, you got to bring your dad to the basketball game.
The Missouri people could have been too happy with the outcome.
No, and there were a fair number of them at the game, so that was nice. But it was a good win for the Irish. I mean, that's the other factor is you're going to give them those, you know, the late start, the bad weather, which normally, you know, which is unusual for this time of December. It wouldn't be unusual in January, and then throw on that the basketball team hasn't been very good for. A few years, so you're relying on local interest. The student turnout was decent, so that, you know, that was good to see. But otherwise, I think, you know, you got to remember for football at Notre Dame, you're selling the whole game weekend to alumni, and there's a lot of people who will, you know, they'll make the pilgrimage for the weekend every year, and, you know, they come in for all the games, or not specific people don't come for all of the games, but all of the games have a lot of people who are coming in for their one trip to Notre Dame every year, and it's a football weekend. Basketball, you're relying on the local market, and I don't think Notre Dame understands at all how to sell men's basketball to the local market, which is strange because they are really, really good at selling women's basketball to the local market. It's, you know, a lot of it's pricing, you know, in a very big way it's pricing. I think my men's season tickets are a bargain, and yet they're still twice as much as women's season tickets.
Still no charge for parking though, right?
No charge for parking.
Well, it's a nice thing. I know when way back in the day, our buddy Doc Doherty and I, we split tickets, figuring, okay, we wouldn't go to a few games, we'd go to some. And you think about it, you know, you left the trading floor at 3:15, if a game is 7 o'clock there, it's 6 o'clock here.
Yeah.
So you could be
back by what, 10 o'clock?
Yeah, you could be. Well, you know, it never once happened. Every single time there was some sort of a weather event, you know, in the wintertime, whether it's rain or snow or something along the lake. And one time, Doc and I drove down on a Saturday, and the tollway had, it was one of these things, we'd be driving along in the sunshine, and all of a sudden you couldn't see anything with the drifting snow, and there were like four fatalities. And then the toll road was closed the way back. We had to make it all the way back on 12 or 20 or something. Finally, we go, that's it. It's our last year. It just is. You can't get there from here enough. I mean, it's even though the hours seem like it's okay, it just never really worked out that way. The best was we're coming back from South Bend. For those that don't know, between South Bend and LaPorte, even though you're in the middle of Indiana, there's not an exit for 27 miles. It's like friggin' Nebraska, for God's sake. So we're like halfway going. The rain is coming down so hard. And Audrey goes, well, we should get off the next exit till the rain dies out. I said, Audrey, we're 15 miles away from the next exit. What do you want me to do? Well, I guess we got to keep going. Oops.
That's not well, and that LaPorte area, that whole south end of the lake too, it just gets so much lake effect weather, and that can be rain, but you know, but when it's snow, it really piles up there. There have been times when I've been going to Chicago, I will leave here in the sunshine, I will arrive in Chicago in the sunshine, but in between, I will, you know, it'll be pouring down snow.
Yeah.
And that's just the weather pattern. And I think, you know, they built the toll road so close to the lake up there, and I know why they did it. It's, you know, it makes a lot of sense from an industry standpoint. But boy, if they had just built it, you know, 5 to 10 miles south, it wouldn't have that same effect.
What do we make of two things? Hal was commenting yesterday about his new conference, and you're gonna have to help me understand the economics of what's going on in the SEC. I'd love to see the books on this stuff, because I don't see how any of this stuff is this dude now. He's not coaching his team in the playoffs. Is that the idea? And he took like three coaches and the general manager with him.
Yeah, I believe so.
All right, start from the beginning. Explain this to me.
Well, what's to explain? They don't. College football is not run well as a business enterprise. In many ways, they are able to drum up a lot of revenue, and so if you look at it from the business standpoint, they're really good on the revenue side. But they do these things that kill them, you know. And you could start a whole litany of them, and frankly, before you get to the things related to the players about, you know, how easy it is to transfer, how many people transfer multiple times, how name, image, and likeness, I would go right to the management side of it, to the coaching side of it, because, you know, in the NFL, for instance, how many coaches get 10-year contracts?
Not very many.
Not very many, if any. So you got, you sign these coaches up to big money 10-year contracts. You owe them a lot of money if you fire them, and by the same token, they don't honor the contracts if they want to leave. Somebody will always buy them out of it to move them to the next place. So it's chaotic. The timeline for coaches is terrible, and by that I mean, you get someone like Kiffin is going to move to LSU. Okay, if you say fine, you're right in the middle of prime recruiting season. Why should he stick around? He's got to get busy on his new job, so that he makes sure he has a recruiting class. So the timeline is terrible for when they hire and fire, because they don't have orderly ways of bringing in the talent, and everything about it is just it's just messed up. And if you turn around and you look at a league like the NFL, that is generally well run, that it's much more rational, because,
well, it's a monopoly. They can be rational.
Well, yeah, I get that, but nevertheless, you know, even a conference can't seem to manage its own house, because Kiffin's leaving within the conference.
All right, so simple, and I, if you have the answers, that easy. You jump even higher, in my opinion. But now he's got. Let's say the normal contract. Let's go back to Kelly's contract. There's no. If Kelly wants to leave early, what happens there? Does somebody owe the school something?
Somebody owes the school something. When Kelly left Notre Dame, he had just had a contract extension the year before.
But I mean, what is if they fired him, they owe him.
Yes,
he
owes the school something. There's some kind of buyout there, but somebody else pays it.
All right. So what would the on an $8 million, 8-year contract, and he decides he's going somewhere else? What's the number on his side? Do you have any idea?
It varies from one to the next. It depends on what the contract specifies.
Are there reasons for those sorts of things? I mean, like, allegedly, we're talking about the coach of Ole Miss leaving and going to LSU and taking Kelly's spot. And the issue there is Ole Miss has a big game this Saturday, and they're probably going to be in the playoffs. So he's the coach. He's not going to coach. He's taking the offense. Somebody got promoted, the defensive coordinator, or somebody up. He's actually taking the general manager as well. Now, okay, so he's not doing his job there. Was he? He's at the end of his contract, though, correct?
Close to it, I'm sure.
I think he might be his.
Assistant coaches generally don't get the same. The same kind of terms on their contracts as others. Some of they've gotten into paying offensive coordinators and defensive coordinators more and getting at least a little bit of a term to their contracts, but they don't get the 10-year terms at $8 to $10 million.
What I'm saying is, it was Kiffin. This is his last year on his contract, correct? At Ole Miss, or was it?
That's a good question. I don't think it is.
Jimmy, how about checking that out, will you? He's good as good.
I'll take a look.
If I'm a money guy, which I guess we are, Kevin, if I'm the chairman of Ole Miss, I'm going to say, okay.
And by the way, Mississippi does not have a game this weekend. It's Georgia and Alabama are in the SEC championship game.
But they're going to be in the 12, probably.
They are highly likely to be in the 12.
Okay. That's right. They don't have the game. It's the other guys. But now, if I'm the chairman, and if I'm, a hard ass, which, boy, this would surely make me be, we, meaning Ole Miss, has spent an awful lot of money over the last 8 weeks, year, bringing a bunch of players recruiting. We're sending coaches out on private jets with the best booze and shrimp cocktails, and we're bringing kids here, and by the way, I don't think we're flying them in on Southwest anymore, are we? I think we're bringing them all in on a private jet, which is insane to me. Now,
well, I think a lot of the visits are commercial.
Okay, so even so, what's the number that we've spent, we, meaning Ole Miss, has spent on recruiting this year that for this guy to say, okay, the 10 of yous, we're all going to LSU and taking all those guys there, I got a real problem with that.
Yeah, there's definitely a problem with that. That was part of why Ole Miss didn't want him to coach the team the rest of the way, because they knew he would be working on the players, the current players. Not that he won't anyway, but with daily contact, he'd be he'd be talking to them about how great it's going to be at LSU next year.
Well, I also was listening to, and I'm going to go into some of the numbers here in LSU in a second, but I was listening to. Actually, was on the bike at the club, Kevin. You're proud of me or what? Listening to the some of the talking heads, and they were talking about this particular issue, and they assumed, never assume, right? They assumed that the big conversation between this guy Kiffin and the people at Ole Miss was some of it about him, also some of it about what are they willing to pony up for in terms of payment for players and practice facilities, and I have no idea what Ole Miss's stuff is like there, and how much of it is that. Well, where would you now, if Ole Miss says, well, 2 years from now, we're not going to have a practice facility, not that I'm saying you should or shouldn't, And oh, by the way, you got $5 million to pay players, and LSU says you got $20 million to pay players. It could be about more than just him. Could be.
Okay, Chief, we do know he did sign an extension worth $54 million through 2031. So they are owed about $12 million on this buyout. Who pays it? I don't know.
Oh, so there is a buyout that's been named at $12
million? Yes.
Yes, and somebody from LSU will wind up paying it. I doubt, because the salary is nearly identical for making the move. So I doubt that Kiffin's going to pay it out of his own pocket. They probably have a booster club or something like that that's going to pay it for him.
So who? How much was that particular talking head? Would you agree with that? It has to do with more the finances of the program than just him. Now, I would think his general manager he brought with was involved in that as well.
I'm not sure what you're asking. Rephrase.
Well, I'm saying these guys claim that the conversation where he decided whether he was going to stay or go had to do, A, with his stuff, but also had to do with how much money they're putting in their program for him to pay players.
Oh, yeah, I think he believes that. There's a cap on what LSU can pay directly. That it's the same for everybody. But I think he just believes the infrastructure in general at LSU is going to give him a better opportunity to win a national championship. Now, again, he's got a one-loss team that's going to be in the playoffs. I don't know how much better an opportunity he's going to get at LSU, but I'm sure he thinks that, you know, the ability to have sustained success there, I think that was Brian Kelly's thing too. I think Brian Kelly didn't think he'd have to do anything, but that he whatever constraints he felt he had at Notre Dame, he wouldn't have at LSU, and therefore it would be easier for him to succeed. Turns out that being an asshole doesn't travel well.
Well, so. I mean, I think you guys. When I say you guys, a few of you on the show, you and Mike and a couple others are convinced that people that somehow these rules are actually going to mean something. I don't think they are. I mean, I think they're all going to be the same in what the universities can pay people. But if Nike or somebody, I don't know what school LSU is, if they're in the habit of paying a whole bunch of people to get you there and having people on commercials and stuff or State Farm, that's all got to count, even though it doesn't count. I mean, I would guess that the LSU contingent of people like that is way bigger than Mississippi's. I would just guess that.
Probably. I would say probably. That's true. Does it have to be? Let's just say Lane Kiffin, who's always been kind of a sleazeball in his...
Oh, yeah.
Let's just say he were to stay at Mississippi and be wildly successful. Do you not think that could grow? I mean, I don't see a constraint in Mississippi because there were no constraints in Alabama, which has a similar, statewide demographic. The only difference being that, Mississippi's got a far better education system. Other than that, if you can succeed on either side of the state of Mississippi, I don't know why you couldn't succeed wildly at Mississippi as well. But I think what you're saying, what Kiffin is telling me is, well, yeah, but I didn't want to do the work to try and build it to that level.
Well, I'm looking at these are the, for those that don't, these are the CNBC numbers. And we touched on this like 2 weeks ago, Kevin, what the top 75 college sports programs are worth. Now, this includes other sports, I guess, but I suppose we should just think about football. They've got University of Mississippi. That's Ole Miss, right? University of Mississippi.
Yeah.
They're 29th. These are the guys that are in Oxford, Mississippi. They got a more of $651 million with revenue at $142. All right. So, which interestingly enough is right about where Indiana is. Mississippi's 29th. Indiana, they got 28th. $653 million, $145 million. Now, ratchet up the chain here to LSU is... I think they're like ninth. All right, I just had them here. Nowhere. Why can't I find them? Well, they got Texas. Who's number one here? Number one is Ohio State, then Texas A&M, then Michigan, Alabama, Notre Dame, Nebraska. I'm kind of surprised Nebraska's up there, higher than Georgia, or right below Georgia. Then it's Tennessee, Penn State. All right, where the hell? Louisiana State is 13th. They think they're worth $916 million. The revenue is $200. So their revenue is like $30 million more than Ole Miss. So not, you know, appreciable, but not amazing amount. Matter of fact, they really don't go much higher on the revenue. Georgia's 210. The only guy that's appreciably higher is Ohio State and Michigan because they've got those huge stadiums. Their revenue is like 270-something. Notre Dame, they got it at 224 when you've said you can't really get that number, but that's what the estimate is.
For all of them, I'd have to see a deeper dive because, what do they have on books? What do they have off books or third-party entities that create things? It's the same thing when you start to look at coaches' salaries, too. What a university is paying them versus what somebody like Nike is paying them as part of the package, as well as what they get for their media stuff if they do a coach's show every week. There's a lot that goes into that. So I think what you're citing is probably pretty good. There may be people that move up or down several notches, but I think for ranking them, it's pretty good. But when you say it's a $10 million difference, I don't know if it really is or not.
Well, I will guess that in the Big Ten, everybody gets the same TV money.
Yep.
And I'm going to say that since Michigan and Ohio State fill up a way bigger stadium with probably higher ticket prices, that should be easy to fix, be easy to calculate. Right? So, I mean,
Revenues are pretty easy to calculate. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And public universities, it's a lot easier to get the information for public universities than it is to get for private universities.
But, I mean, I think you and I can look at, our home base, South Bend. Okay, they're going to get 80,000 people in there. Subtract 10,000 students, which means you got 10,000 paying people, or 70,000. $100 a ticket. Well, duh. I mean, you and I can do that. Guess what? If the stadium's $100,000, that's another $20,000 times $100, right? I mean, it's you know. Then you got the stuff where people giving money to the school to get the tickets. That I agree with you, but by and large, it's not.
Well, and then on a weekend like that, how much licensed material do they sell?
Yeah.
So you start piling that in, plus licensed material that you sell everywhere. So it adds up, and that's what I mean. It's pretty hard to pull it together entirely, and I don't know how much of that is on book versus off book. So,
Wisconsin,
you have a pretty good thumbnail of it. I think that for our purposes, that's fine.
I mean, I would guess someplace like Wisconsin, what do they hold? 85 or 90, yet probably 40,000 are students, right? So that brings you down to 55. That's a little less, because Michigan doesn't.
Unless they make students pay, I don't know if they do.
Yeah, maybe. Well, it's not the same number. I don't think they're paying $100. Well, they used to say at Notre Dame it was free. I always said it was included, right? There's somewhat of a difference. But we had to pay for basketball and hockey tickets, as I recall.
Yeah.
So what? So now the dude gets in there. The thing that now this guy is promising, they're going to bring LSU the national championships they're used to. Now, they just hired some schmo in Florida. Now, they're going to hire another guy at Ole Miss, unless they give the
defense. Florida hired Tulane's coach, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying every one of them is promising this championship. And as the teams get better and better, and at some point you're going to stop playing Eastern Illinois if you're Alabama, I think, nobody is going to be 12-1. But guess what? Last time I checked, Kevin, there's only one national championship a year, and now we have, 15 guys promising a national championship. Is that 14 people disappointed, or what are we doing here?
Well, they're all disappointing as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean,
Well, that's what I mean. Is that really a way to run a business? When you start thinking about it, and the money that you're going to pay for that is preposterous. And what are we going to do? We're going to fire the guy in 3 years, or is he going to succeed? Is he going to embarrass you? Because when you know you're not hiring people with high, you know, the greatest character in the world, are you setting yourself up for embarrassment? Yeah, there's a lot there. That, you know, who was the Bobby Petrino was the guy that Arkansas. You know, this gets into another. You know, is this a way to run a business? Bobby Petrino got fired from his job as the head coach at Arkansas. He had been at Louisville, he got fired because he was having an affair with a young woman who I guess started when she was a student, but now she was working for the athletic department. He got her the job. They got into a motorcycle accident. One afternoon, he lied not only to the media but to his boss about her being there or not being there, and ultimately for his dishonesty and trying to cover up what was going on, wound up getting fired, and they hired him back this year as the offensive coordinator.
Well, the guy at Northwestern just paid his penance too, right?
Yeah.
What do you say we go to a quick break here, Kevin, and then we'll be right back. S&P futures up 15, NASDAQ futures up 43. We'll be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here,
right now, right here,
right now,
right now. We're back. Welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Jimmy on the board. S&P futures up 15. The NASDAQ futures up 40. We were up a little more than that, but we are still up. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 67.3%. FTSE down 12.1%. Call that almost flat. CAC round up 2. Call that flat. There's not much going on over there. We're in Asia, we got the Nikkei up 561, that's 1.1%. Hang Seng down 334, 1.3%. So that's a flip-o there. Shanghai down 19.5%, so kind of a mixed bag over in Asia. Banks down 3 basis points, 4.06. Interest rates have been up this week, although we're down a little bit today. The Bund down 1 basis point, 2.74. Oil up 81 cents still, 59.45. Is it races to 60? Back down from 60 up to 62. Oil has been about a crummiest trader. And interesting, last time oil in the XLE had this crummy of a year a few years ago, and pretty much every investor wanted to bail out of it, and had a good year the next year. Now, I don't know what's, if that's going to be the deal this year or not. I suspect not, but I don't know. I have to talk to a lot of my investors and see what they want to stick with their XLE positions or not. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Brent up 73 cents, 63.18. It looks like it's a dead puppy to me, this oil, but that can change by June, July, or whatever. Gold up $16, 42.37. Silver up 21 cents, 58.91. Foreign exchange, dollar, a ninth straight loss as Fed outlook dominates. So we're up to almost 117 on the euro. We were under 115 the other day. These are moves. These are 1% moves. They're big moves. British pound up is 132. Again, we were 129 not that long ago. Crypto, big bounce here. Well, we're only up 1,600. We're up more than that earlier. 92,801 on the Bitcoin. Got down to, I think it traded a nanosecond under 80, but now it's back to 92. Jimmy, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Well, in traffic, we have the inbound Kennedy from Montrose at 12 minutes right now. As we go down, the inbound Edens from Lake Cook is 26. Inbound the Eisenhower from Wolf is 28. The Dan Ryan, the inbound from 95th is 21. In weather today, it's 24 degrees with a high of 33. It's cold at times, cloudy, overcast, and flurries in Chicago. In Phoenix, it's 47 with a high of 67, mostly sunny and pleasant. Sports, it was just really NBA last night. The Celtics did beat the Knicks. And we are having, tomorrow is the Cowboys versus the Lions, so that's a big one for the Bears. And back to you.
Yo, Kevin, the high school football, in order to watch that tonight, you got to have the high school football game package. Do you believe that?
Yeah, well, not interested. So, hey, let me finish a thought on that. There's something else I want to get to.
I was going to ask you, the thought here is I've got LSU with $200 million in revenue. So this guy's going to get 10. His assistant coaches are going to get something. You got to pay the general manager a chunk. So you're going to pay the top five people, and then all your they're going to fill up this $200 million of revenue with expenses pretty darn fast, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
What I have to ask you just a real simple question from a man who teaches all kinds of management and things like that. Let me get this straight, Lucy. We hired some bozo for $8 million a year for 8 years. We don't like him. We dump him. Now we got to pay out whatever the settlement is. So within like 3 weeks, we hire another bozo, $10 million for 10 years. Is there an adult anywhere in this room?
Yeah, I think that's the perfect question. Is there anybody that, you know, is really exercising any judgment? They are actually operating their franchise there like somebody might operate a fantasy football franchise.
Well, is there this, and you know, and I've had people in the adult emporiums that sometimes I hang out in tell me, well, you know, it's the alumni. Are there really that many alumni dying to write millions of dollars worth of checks so their team can win, so they can go in the shower and see if something grew? I mean, what are we doing here? I'd like to see Notre Dame win, but I mean, at some point, what am I doing? I mean, that would not be my first charity. Just saying.
I agree with you. And you know, we mentioned the Tulane coach going what did we say, Florida?
Now those guys are going to be in playoffs too. He's not going to coach them either?
Yeah, well, and this is what I'm getting at, is this cascades through the whole system. And that's why I said, would you really run a whole enterprise like this with no constraints on the management team movement, any of that kind of stuff? Nobody rational would do it this way. And yet, when it comes to college athletics, that's exactly what they do.
Well, I don't like the idea of people being able to steal the recruits that I paid for.
Agreed.
So, I mean, this is, you know...
There was a time that was honored, that, you know, people did not poach like that. And there was even a time when a recruit announced his commitment to a school that the custom was to stop recruiting him. Well, that's been gone for a long time.
Well, yeah, you keep calling them. But I guess on a personal level, I'll ask our friend James here as well. If all of a sudden a piece of mail came here into PTI Securities that said, hey, Chief, here's $1 billion, charitable organization that's going to be run by Jim Lawler and Kevin O'Neill, and you manage it, and you're on the board, okay? Well, you're not the chairman of the board. One of you guys would be if you're running it. I can't imagine if we got to give away. And Jimmy does some of this because his family has a. If we're going to give away $100 million a year I don't even know where, with all the suffering going on around us, when any of us would say, gee, why don't we give $10 million to Notre Dame for a new football coach? How does that even percolate up, for God's sake? And we like the place. I mean, I don't even get that. I mean, I suppose if you two guys want your carcasses in the skybox every Saturday and people whining and dining, there's some reward to that, but that's not a charity. What the hell's that? I mean, I don't even get it. How does this money just manage to pop up from somebody? Because my view of a lot of people who have a lot of money is they have it because they don't spend it. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but I don't know what else there is to say. It's not rational in any way.
These people must be getting something out of it, Kevin.
Yeah, their name on a seat, something like that.
Well,
yeah. I mean, if you look at it, let's look at yesterday. Michael Dell is giving $6 billion away to put people into the Trump accounts, 225 million things. Are you telling me Michael Dell is doing that for charity, or is there something government contract that he might get?
I have no idea. I wish I knew.
Yeah, there may be government contracts he might get, but also, you know, as a marketing move, he's, you know, if these are to, you know, educate, especially, you know, underclass, because a lot of businesses do this. Samsung is kind of notorious for it, where Samsung will go put up computer labs in underserved places, whether it be, you know, in the middle of Africa with satellite links, or in the middle of Watts in L.A., because all they're really doing is they're building up their next generation of customers. And they want a robust consumer of technology. So there will be that part of it for Dell, is that, you know, to the extent that they grow an underclass into becoming consumers, then, you know, there's a long-term marketing push to that as well. But yeah, this may also be, I want government contracts. I want to put all the servers in government buildings. So, you know, there's many angles to this, some legit and some a little shadier.
But there's nothing, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with it, Kevin. I mean, if a city wants to invest in a horrible neighborhood, an underclass neighborhood, with the idea that in 10 years we're going to have 30% people paying taxes instead of draining the system, I don't think that's a bad investment. Do you, if it works?
Oh, and that's what I said. Yeah. You know, I know Samsung does that as an example, another technology company, but it's not just them. It's, you know, it is people like Dell, people like Apple. Apple, you know, makes a lot of computers available to inner city school systems. It's all there, and that's part of it. But before we run out of time, and I do have a hard stop at 8 o'clock,
okay. So
I got to do it. I just wanted to follow up. You had the discussion yesterday about cryptocurrencies and blockchain yesterday with Carl, and there are many other uses that don't relate specifically to cryptocurrencies for it. And I think if you understand some of the other use cases for it, it makes it a little bit easier to understand what's going on with Bitcoin. So Carl described how, before you add another block to the chain, because you never change anything in blockchain.
Well, that's the story.
Well, you don't. You can't. If you go in and change a block, did you play with any of the stuff I sent you yesterday?
I didn't have a chance to, but I'm saying all this is, I guess, Kevin. Go ahead, but it's sort of taken on faith. What if there is a hack?
So what happens is if you go change it. The way these things are chained together is that you have something called a hash, and that was one of the things I sent you, is if you just type in one letter into the input, it creates this really, really long string of hexadecimal numbers, and then if you enter one more letter, that changes immediately. The point being that the contents of a block get hashed, and then the next block points using the hash, it has a pointer back to the hash of the previous block. So when you break a previous block, all of a sudden you have the subsequent block saying, that's not right. You broke something there. And so that's one of several security features. The second thing is, if you make that change, theoretically you could go change all of these hash pointers back, you know, through the block, except that there's a slowdown process called I think it's called proof of ownership now, or proof of work, that takes time. And Carl was talking about this yesterday, where it takes time to recalculate before you add that next block to the chain. And then everybody who participates in this gets their own copy of the ledger, so you still have to populate everybody else's ledger with the same block. So and you'll see that, you'll understand it more when you watch that 6-minute video I sent you. It's real simple, straightforward explanation. The reason I bring this up, though, is when you think of Bitcoin, it's basically everybody who has ever had anything to do with a specific coin is a participant in the ledger. When you talk about other business applications for blockchain, you don't necessarily have everybody participating. And so there are companies, IBM is really big into this, but there are many companies that run blockchain platforms. And so you can subscribe. An example of blockchain, because you only add, you can trace backwards through the ledger to find the source of something. About 4 or 5 years ago, we had all the romaine lettuce, contamination, and in a blockchain world, and this is where Walmart has gone with its suppliers, but in a blockchain world at the time, instead of pulling every head of romaine lettuce off of the shelves everywhere in the United States, because we didn't know where the contamination source was, instead, you would be able to just scan the barcode associated with the head of lettuce, and then you would backtrace it to the source. You would find the common source. Could be a grower, could be farther into the supply chain where it's a contamination at a distribution center. It could be a lot of places, but then you say, just pull those off the shelves. The others are okay. That's one example.
You were able to do some of that. Didn't that start in the early 60s? The things where you could scan?
Well, yeah, you can barcode scan, and you can add the databases, but the databases are distributed.
Okay.
When you're talking about Walmart and its suppliers, every supplier has its own copy of the ledger, as does Walmart, not only does everybody have it, instead of each individual owning its own, so that you would have to say, okay, I got it as far as you, Tom, now you have to look it up and see how it got to where it was. And the point is, in a blockchain world, you would just, in 5 minutes, you would have it.
Well, I have an issue. I mean, I don't know why I'm being contrary, because I want to get more information out of you. Take for instance my brother, all right? Now, if this is so friggin' sophisticated, years
it's not ago, that it's been around since the 90s.
Okay, but it's okay. But he went to an ATM, sees a thing.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about cryptocurrencies in this discussion.
Well, my point is, if every little gnat who's ever been in there, you can find what his behind looks like. How is it that if he has a credit card receipt at an ATM from 10 years ago and knows the exact date and time that he bought $20 worth of Bitcoin, somebody can't give him the fact that it's really his because he lost the password? Where is it? Somebody's going to get that $16.
It's not that somebody can't tell him that it's really his, but he can't. And if he can't log into his cryptocurrency wallet where it's held because he doesn't know the password, nobody else knows the password.
I'm saying that particular day is when he created his password. So how do they not go? Can't they go back to the transaction with the same credit card number and say this is yours?
Yeah, I don't think anybody publishes a password, and passwords are encrypted. In fact, passwords are generally not stored anywhere. There are algorithmic results of a password, and usually when you enter a password, it's going to run through an algorithm and compare it to your algorithm's results.
Okay. What I'm saying is, when people say it's going to get regulated, it's going to get something, there's nobody to call. In any other transaction in the world, if you've got a date and time and a credit card receipt, and I bought this, whatever, I bought something online, and by the way, this is me. Somebody says, "Oh yeah, that's you." I mean, how is it we can have this all this stuff where supposedly is nobody in charge, and oh by the way, all this money's quote missing.
Okay, so you've taken us off track, but I'll give you an answer, right, and then I'm going to go back on track. Think of it more like this: when you control your own cryptocurrency wallet rather than having it in an exchange, because the little teeny bit of crypto that I own is I got at Coinbase. So, you know, I can go back to Coinbase and have my account reset, and I can get into it that way if I lose my password.
Okay.
But if I don't and I intend to operate myself, it's more like I take all of my cash and I put it in a safe, and then I forget the combination to the safe. Are you going to fix that for me? Can you, if I go to you and say, "Hey, Tom, I put it in this safe and I forgot the combination. You going to have the combination for me?"
But you took the money out of the system. This is still in the system. The idea that nobody's ever been able to find it. Anyway, keep going.
I didn't take the money out of the system. It's the U.S., United States cash.
You took it out of the bank. You're driving it home in your electric vehicle, the car had a fire, and your cash burned up. Well, that's on you. But I'm saying this stuff is there somewhere, and I'm supposed to believe that if somehow I live to be 150, it's still there waiting for me to come in with the password. I don't believe that. I just never will. Nobody can get there.
Okay. But, like I said, I want to get back on track, though.
Go ahead.
Another possible use case. Cold chain. Let's just say you are shipping. It could be pharmaceuticals. It could be food that has to remain frozen. And you want to make sure as it goes through your distribution system that the temperature, the storage temperature, never rises above a certain amount of, a certain threshold. And you want to know that because let's just say I'm transporting frozen vegetables across the country, and they unfreeze because my refrigerated shipping container had a problem. I could just say, who the hell's going to know? Put it back, you know, fix the stuff, freeze it again, and send it. And of course, that's not as good, and that's not what a retailer would want. One of the blockchain use cases is that that you're taking those temperatures like on a regular basis. Could be every minute if you wanted it, but every half hour, something like that, and you're just taking the shipping container, it's just broadcasting that to a blockchain, and it's just building up the data over and over and over again, so that you as a wholesaler or as a retailer buying from a wholesaler or a distributor would know for a fact that it has been properly temperature controlled at every step of the way. That would be particularly important for medications that have to be stored at cold temperatures. So you're looking at those kind of things. That's a blockchain type of use case where every time it gets handed off, it just continues to build the data on the block, and it can get very big. You know, it can be a huge amount of data, but you would always be able to have that transparency to go back through the blockchain and just say, are there any instances of temperature rising above?
So you're saying 45? That one of my first jobs was at a food store that once in a while the frozen vegetables didn't show up on a freezer truck. Do you think they'd have caught them, you're saying?
Yeah, you know.
It might not have been a bad idea.
Yeah, well, it might not have been. Another example, your healthcare records. Who holds your healthcare records now?
I don't know, but I just got a class action settlement, the first one I ever got from some hospital I was in years ago, and they said this stuff got hacked, so I wanted to be in the class. And I said, sure, I just got a check for $30. I don't even know what they hacked.
All right, and you didn't call me up and say, Kevin, I'm going to buy you a beer.
Well, I could do that. I'd do that anyway.
Bucks.
Usually they're like for a dollar and a half or something, those checks, aren't they? Because we get some.
So it's more of a fine to the company than it is a boon to the recipients. But So you get your medical records. They are stored. Your primary care physician is going to have a set of records, and right now, a lot of that gets shared within a healthcare system. But if you want to go to, first of all, if you want your brother to be able to have access to your medical records, because he's the person that's going to decide whether to pull the plug or not, then you have to give him special permission, and then he has to go to the source of your medical records. And then if you want to see a specialist, you have to give permission for the specialist to see your medical records, and the specialist then will be able to go to your source and get it. Well, if you put all of your medical records on a blockchain and you controlled it, you could give permission to people to access the ledger real easily. It's just, tap, 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 you go in and do it. And you could just as easily revoke those permissions when you want to change your mind. So, if somebody were married and they said, my wife gets all my permissions, and then they get divorced, is my wife doesn't have permission to this anymore, and the new wife gets permission to it. Those kinds of things. You just get more control over your own medical records. We're not there yet, but that's a model that would make HIPAA almost obsolete.
Maybe you want both wives having to agree to pull the plug.
Yeah, that you probably get. The diamond industry is using it to try and keep to keep stolen diamonds out of the supply chain, and to try and keep blood diamonds out of the supply chain, because you can't just inject them in out of nowhere.
I think that
gets to who. It's not like anybody in the world can get into that ledger. That's the thing, is if you're a diamond distributor, the permission on, I think they're on IBM's platform, the permission to get to that is only people who have been granted permission. So now if I'm a diamond thief and I've stole a bunch of diamonds, how am I going to get permission to get in there and inject these diamonds into the supply chain? I
don't have. Two things. One is, I probably had 30 people along the way that are really into Bitcoin, and they'll tell me about blockchain. And somehow or another, Kevin, they think they own the blockchain. I don't know what message has gotten into their feeble brains with that. What you and Carl tell me about the blockchain, I find it absolutely fascinating. But the fact is, you don't own it by owning Bitcoin. And I think a lot of people somehow get some idea that they do, which is pretty
scary.
You
have your copy of the ledger that tracks all of it. That's all you have. But everybody else who has ever touched that transaction also has a copy of the ledger for it.
What you're talking about, and there's no reason for me to debate how Bitcoin should be or ought to be. What you're saying makes all the sense in the world. My concern, as always, is, hey, what about this? I see what happens with PTI securities. I see what happens to our banks and all this money that's at the treasurer's office. And here's some other group. Oh, no, we don't have to keep track of anybody's crap. Well, okay. I don't say there's anything wrong with it, but there's quite a gap there, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and that's why I said you'll understand Bitcoin a little bit better, but I don't, when it comes to blockchain, I don't care very much about Bitcoin personally.
Yeah.
Like I said, I bought some cryptos, and we're just talking a couple hundred bucks worth, not anything of substance. But I did it just to see what it's about and to see how it works. But I don't do anything with it. I haven't transacted anything with it. I just get something from Coinbase that tells me it went up 5% or it went down 5% yesterday.
You just want the neighbors to know you're getting the big letter from Coinbase every month that you must be a big shot.
Yeah, that's probably it. But but what I am, as a supply chain guy, I'm very interested in it as technology for supply chains. And that's where it's used, and that's where the access to the ledger is closed. But still, you still have those same security features, which are, one is distributed ledger. So everybody's got to agree. Carl talked about that. It's called consensus, and you have to have enough people agree to any change before you add a block. that everybody else has had gone through the same proof of work algorithm. So that proof of work algorithm is important. The consensus is important. The encryption is important. And the hashing is important. And those are the features. And you'll see that. You'll see that in a 6-minute video I sent you that is really, you know, easy to understand. And when they give your hashing example, it's like 4 digits on the video. And but in reality, and that's why I sent you another link to a hashing website, you'll see that it's not 4 digits. It's a very long.
Whatever I've said it 3 times. I find this absolutely fascinating, and how it's going to help people in a lot of places. And I don't think I get all that, Kevin, but I understand what you're telling me. I'm just saying, to me, for a lot of people who are looking at this, it is an investment of some kind. All right.
And that's why I said I don't want to talk about cryptos today, because that's investments, and I'm not talking about it in terms of investments. Cryptocurrency itself, like I said, I don't have a lot of personal use for it.
That was not the thrust of my argument at all.
Other than to dabble a little bit, you know, I don't get it.
No, what I'm saying is, if you plunked $100,000 in PTI. And you put $100,000 in Bitcoin, which is, as you know, it's sort of like what we're talking about, the Bitcoin is an artificial stock, basically. Well, I can only imagine if you call up, if you forget your account number at PTI, and you call up Dan or me, Dan probably get it quicker than I can, say, hey, Dan, I forgot my account number. Oh, you did? Ha-ha, see ya. That would be one interesting response, right?
Well, yeah. So, who are you going to call for Bitcoin?
That's my point. That's the whole point for the whole thing. It becomes an investment for people. The blockchain is an amazing mechanism, but it's not much of a. It sure as hell isn't the same as having somebody here to call or at a bank.
We're on the hour.
Oh, what if you sent me a stock certificate and I locked it in the safe and then I forgot it?
You know what? The transfer agent would know you have it, and we could get it back for you.
Okay.
Because they would have to send you, they'd have to have your address. Because if they send you a dividend, they send you a check, right? They don't just eat it. You could get it back. It would be a struggle, but we get it back.
Yeah. Well, so that's, you know, that's similar to what, you know, I don't think I would recommend to anybody that they, you know, manage their own wallet, because there are issues. If I keel over and die, how would my kids know to get in there?
Yeah.
So you know, I would have some issues like that. But in general, it's fine if people want to transact in cryptocurrencies. You know, more power to you. But for my purposes, I'm more interested in the blockchain technology itself,
which to me seems
for different
great
causes than cryptocurrencies.
Kevin,
and that's one, you know, it's one thing to stress for people. Blockchain does not equal cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency uses blockchain, but so does everybody in the supply chain world, or so is more and more.
And that's what you teach a lot of, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though. Didn't the course
called Supply Chain Technologies, it's a piece of it.
Didn't the cryptocurrencies, though, precede the Coinbase?
Probably. I mean, geez, they started, you know, what was it? You'll get a little history lesson in the video link I sent you, but the technology has been around since the 90s, and yeah, that people started doing Bitcoin before that. Hey, I gotta go.
All right, bud, you take care of yourself. Up 19.
You got Dr. Larissa on the line, so you can smoothly transition.
We'll smoothly transition. Hey, Larissa, how are you?
Good, and nice to hear from you. And good morning, Kevin.
Morning and goodbye. See ya.
I think he's heading off to a class or something. You know how that works, Larissa.
I do. Sometimes classes sneak up on you.
How are you happy with this? I'm going to say 3-week early winter.
It's interesting. I didn't know what to expect in West Lafayette, and it's a little more icy than I was anticipating. So you know, in Chicago, we're accustomed to the ice.
Yep.
But I was a little surprised at how much ice we had, particularly on campus. So that surprised me, because in the city, most of the sidewalks are pretty well cleared on a regular basis. So you're not necessarily walking on ice in the loop. So this was a little surprising. I'll say that.
South Bend is, I think it snows all the time there.
Does it?
You're kind of at the end of the, I guess it's lake effect snow, but you're kind of at the end of that. As a matter of fact, my brother, one of the reasons why every accounting firm wanted him when he graduated, they used to run this charitable thing where people went and gambled, like for charity. It was called N-Toastal, or whatever the hell it was called. And he ran that, and you could serve beer. When I was involved 4 years before, you couldn't serve beer. So they went out and he bought, I don't know how many cases of beer for this thing. And they had it in there, and all of a sudden they got this snowstorm that was so intense, people were walking over the tops of cars. It was like that bad. And so they pushed the thing out for 2 weeks, and they canceled school for like 3 or 4 days.
So, oh, goodness.
So he sold all the beer to the guys on campus at like a nice profit.
Sure.
And then so he'd already made more money than this thing had ever made before it even started.
That's great. Good for
him. Of course, the weather got better, and he went out and bought the beer again.
Of course, yeah.
it is amazing. But the one fair part is you didn't want to have a convertible, because if people were walking along the tops of cars and yours happened to be a convertible, and went to top.
Oh, yeah.
So no, that's,
that would
be bad. So what's been happening? Do you assume you had a good Thanksgiving and a whole bit? Were you here, or where were you?
Yeah, I was here. Thanksgiving was good. We set up the Christmas tree. We started getting things ready for the holidays. It's just a lot of fun.
Well, a lot of stuff happens when you're snowed in, you know, you get all...
Yeah, and that was a lot of fun. I actually really enjoyed being snowed in. I enjoyed the whole part of it. I enjoyed not having to go anywhere, and I enjoyed, like, the lack of errands, so to speak.
Poor guy in a building, one of my friends, his father passed away in Mexico, so he had to leave on Wednesday and come back on Saturday.
Ooh.
I mean, he was okay because he left at like 6 in the morning or something, but man, the airport was just disaster the whole weekend.
I mean, oh, I believe it.
So what's current? We're going over this the money involved in these coaches flying back and forth in the SEC. So far, the Big Ten really hasn't done that much of that. Although Michigan State just hired the guy from Northwestern that got booted because of the hazing incident a few years ago. Not so sure how close he was to that, but anyway. Nobody knows, but the economics of it is really bizarre, isn't it? Where one guy, you fire one guy that you owe $8 million to for 7 years, and you hire a new guy for 10 years at $10 million. You wonder, where's the adult in the room? Go ahead.
And I can't blame the coaches and the athletes for jumping on board for this. I mean, it's a unique opportunity for them. If I were offered these kinds of salaries, I would not be disappointed.
No. You know what's funny, and I guess I could, I won't blame the professors. I'll kind of blame the times a little bit. I had a couple of discussions where we're talking about the guy from LSU, Kelly, and near as I can figure, it's printed, he's owed, let's just say, $8 million a year for 7 years, which is 56. It actually is like 54 and a half, so I don't know, somehow or another, there's a half a year they're missing. But and I've had discussions with people about they owe him that. And it's so funny, Larissa, when I graduated and was studying in school, the interest rates were so high. Everybody knew present value tables, future value tables. Everybody knew. Now it's been so long that there hasn't been any interest. Nobody even kind of knows that. And I was having this discussion with people that are pretty darn bright, and they go, well, they owe the guy $56 million. I go, no, they don't. They owe him $8 million 7 years from now. That's not $8 million. Pick an interest rate. It's either, it could be 3, it could be 7, depending on and they're looking at me like I had 4 heads. Have we stopped? Or is it just people, it's not part of people's daily routines and knowing what, you know, present values are and future values, and we haven't had interest rates for so long that people have forgotten all about them, or what?
Well, and it's... That's one of the things I teach, is just really manipulating present value. And I keep trying to explain to the students, I said, all finance is really discounting future cash flows back to today. Doesn't matter what asset you're looking at, that's the fundamentals of valuing every single asset. So I even try to write up all of the equations that we're doing for this discounting, whether it be we're looking at stocks or bonds or derivatives, but I try to write the equations so that they look similar, so that students can understand it's really just a series of future cash payments. It is, in this case, it'd be the annual salary. And then you're going to discount back each of those years because it could be a different interest rate for that year, but there's also the sensitivity of time. And it's really just a series of discounted future cash flows.
Yeah, I mean,
they struggle.
They struggle because it's not in their.
Mm-mm.
It's kind of not. It's not like you're going to the bank and getting 10% where you get. What do you call it? You get reinforcement. There's no reinforcement to it, is there?
No, and I'm teaching personal finance for the first time in the spring, and I noticed that, yes, they talk about time value of money and future value and present value, but it's really not taught in a way that can be really understood or really applied, if that makes sense. So it's just this very theoretical concept that doesn't seem to make any applications to your actual life. And to your point about that reinforcement, if you can't apply it to your life, particularly in finance, it's something that you're not going to ever think about again.
Right. And it's, I've kind of gotten on this shtick a little bit because Professor Hell was on yesterday, and he just did a class in the history of economic thought. And he's putting one together, I think, in money and banking. And I said, Hell, probably want to get you on the list because some of the stuff that he sends around is pretty darn good. Maybe Russell shares, but anyway, we have to get you on the list. But he's sending some stuff around lately on the differences in the last 10 or 15 years, and you can kind of point your finger at it. And this, I don't know why I should have sent it to you. I'm sorry, but I know a lot of stuff has changed since Dodd-Frank, and evidently with the 2007 fiasco. I heard this rumor that Greenspan had inserted something into what was the law that came through there? The act that came through where we bailed all these people out. It wasn't called the Bailout Act. Help me here. It was there was some act that went on in 2008 or 2009 regarding helping these people out.
Yeah, so I'd say the only one that comes to mind is Dodd-Frank from that time period.
Well, there was another one. It was called I don't know. It had to do with fixing everybody, giving everybody cash, these firms and so forth. Well, they put something in there regarding you don't really need reserve requirements anymore. That it's going to be taken over by essentially banks' capital requirements. And I said to Hal, and I'll ask you. I said, Hal, if I pick up a money and banking book, I probably have a couple of them at home. Should I just toss them? I mean, if I went took a class on banking, money and banking, now are they still going to talk about reserve requirements, or are they all about capital requirements? I mean, if I went back to learn it, I have to start from scratch. I have no idea what they do on these capital requirements, other than anecdotal evidence from people saying, well, that's why the clearing agents have their own input into the Fed now, because the banks won't take the money or something. Have all those books been kind of brought up to speed, or are they still teaching the old stuff?
So this is not something I directly teach, but I used to teach about the Federal Reserve requirement and I taught it as a way for the Federal Reserve to be able to control the overall economy. So if you wanted to slow things down, you would raise that requirement up, and vice versa if you wanted to speed things up. And it's interesting because it's not a part of the curriculum that I'm teaching now. I don't know that students really get it in a lot of other places. So it's not necessarily something that would fall under in my investments class. I hope it is covered in economics, but that would be a freshman level class. And I'm not entirely sure how deep they go into the Fed. Russell and I were just talking yesterday about creating a new video series specifically on around the Fed and what they do, how they do it, and how the income, or not the income, the impact of what the Fed does and how it impacts the economy. Because I don't know that that's necessarily something that's really highlighted in a lot of finance curriculums.
What do you think is going to happen when this guy's out, Powell? I mean, it's in May, right?
It is, I think so, yeah.
Now, he traditionally, when they're out, they resign, but he doesn't have to, right? He's got another 2 years as a board member. He could just be out as chairman. I don't think.
And I believe he doesn't want to resign.
Well, he doesn't want to resign from the chairmanship until he's out. But right. He's never said that maybe he has. I don't think he said that he's not. I think the administration is salivating over his board seat.
Oh, I think so too.
But I mean, he could say, I'm not going anywhere for 2 years.
Right.
I don't think he will, but it looks to me like he's pretty much had it with the whole mess. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, what, you know, if they're going to just drive rates down and so forth here. I don't know that that's kind of, I sent something to our guys last night talking about the inflation situation. And Hal was, he does a, I don't know, logarithmic kind of thing where he takes all the weeklies. You can't get the money supplies on a weekly basis now, but if you go back to last month, the last month they give you, they'll tell you what it was during the week. So it's kind of weird to give it to you in history, but not going forward. And he does a kind of a regression analysis to say where we're heading. And at one point he was up to where we'd be 11% increase next year, but now it's flattened out a little bit. So he thinks that has... it's not going to be 11, it might be 6 or 7 or 8. And I wrote back and I said, well, you know, the problem is not so much that they used to call it the professors back in those days, long before you and Russell were doing this stuff. They used to call it kind of like a stock and flow analysis, where right now I don't think our problem, and you can grade me on this as I'm saying it, our problem is not so much whether the inflation going forward is 2 or 3 or 4. I mean, we'd rather have it 2 than 4. But that, to me, is not the issue. We had an 18-month to 2-year time period over two presidents that I think were two worst I've ever come across, that essentially blew the money supply up 40% in 18 months. And I think the inflation from that is in the 35 to 40% range, all of a sudden in a bubble. And people's salaries have not... anywhere near over the few years after grown up to meet that. So we've got this essentially chunk out of your behind that going forward, it almost doesn't matter. And it does matter. We don't want a 10% or 6, but people are just waiting around for the next car repair or the rest air conditioner to go out or the rest new roof. They don't have the money for it. So we're still locked, in my opinion, in a phenomenon that I think I've ever seen before or ever read about. That there's one... You know, it's almost like your sticker for your car went up $500 in 1 year and then never went up again. Well, the inflation going forward would be zero, but you're still stuck, right? I don't even know where you'd put that in anything I learned.
So that's the idea of you've got... Well, so in economics, we talk about sticky wages, but we're actually looking at sticky prices at this moment, right? So when we have a better competition, what you should theoretically be seeing is producers or suppliers creating new products at better quality and at reduced prices, so that prices will begin to contract. And we haven't seen that, right? We haven't seen this kind of new competition. What we have seen a lot of suppliers do is put out these products and with the inflated prices and say, okay, now that's the price. And as opposed to looking at new technologies to reduce that price, suppliers have kept those prices where they are because of this uncertainty of what's going to happen going forward, right? So the supplier is on the other end of it saying, okay, well, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm stuck with a bunch of inventory, or I don't want to be in a situation where I'm stuck and tariffs have gone up and now I have to pass on those tariffs, or how do I price in those tariffs? there's so much uncertainty that it's easier for them to keep those higher prices.
Well, I mean, if they may not even determine them. They might be competitive in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
And if you
absolutely.
Well, if you double the amount of money in the system, you're going to double all the prices, right?
Right. But to your point, though, people's salaries haven't gone up. So we're going to see, well, we should see, and we haven't seen this, a slowdown in purchasing. So we should see the economy start to contract a bit because people don't have as much money to spend. However, we're not necessarily seeing that in the overall market.
Well, if you look at the numbers, and again, the numbers are, I guess, you know, it can be almost fictional. How would you even, I mean, because you guys are closer to this than me, how would you actually even look at, when you have a K-shaped, which they call now a K-shaped recovery, where some people seem to have more money than they know what to do with? I mean, we're talking about, you know, baseball teams being you know, $8 billion kind of thing. If you have, you know, 100 people that are trying to get their used car fixed, it's 30 years old, and yet two people go out and buy the latest $150,000 Mercedes, the numbers could look okay in terms of, you know, gross purchases, but they're sort of not okay. I mean, how do you, if these guys, if the government continues to push money supply up at 5% a year, and cheats on the PCE deflator, we will never have a recession. It'll never look like things are bad, and yet they could very well be. How do you get around that? Or does anybody even know what the hell I'm talking about? I guess is the question.
So I completely agree with you. Just so you know, maybe very up for front about that. I believe that is happening right now. I think there is such a separation in our society of people who have disposable income for these types of things compared to people who don't. I think this is a trend that it's the gap is widening, and this is a very scary trend because, to your point, it looks like the economy is doing well. So it almost could be made the argument of, well, maybe we should increase rates because we want to slow down the economy because it's doing so well. But you and I both know that a lot of people, if you were to increase rates at this moment, it would be detrimental to them.
Well, it'd be detrimental to anybody who has fixed assets.
Right. It's
and the market, for God's sake, for sure.
But it would slow down the market.
Right.
Would be the point of raising the rates. But again, once you start to aggregate, because of this disparity, once you start to aggregate those numbers, it does paint a very different picture than what a lot of people are feeling on a day-to-day basis.
Yep, it's kind of interesting because, sort of in our lifetime, this is 2000, it's a while ago, with Y2K, kind of a simple but real example. The Fed before Y2K, and I know this is before your time, but they were so convinced that everything was going to fall apart on Y2K, right?
For those well, that
remember. And they put a lot more money into the system. And the stock market was already doing the 1999, 1988 dot-bomb stuff. So what they did is they really poured a lot of gasoline on the fire. So
yes,
the last piece of the market going up really was probably on the Fed, just pouring money into the system. But then when they did that, the minute the calendar changed, they said, wait a minute, we put too much money in here. We better start dragging it out. So they start dragging some of it out, which would be the normal way to do this, right? And of course, it kind of caught everybody just when people figured out that the dot bomb was all a joke to start with, and all of a sudden the market came flying down. But
right.
Now, but this time, they put all that money in so they could send out checks during COVID and everything. Somehow or another, somebody got a bird got in their ear and said, "Wait a minute, you're not taking the market down this time. We like it up here."
So we do. Say,
yeah, we like it up here, and we want to keep it up here. And, oh, by the way, we want housing prices up here, too. So I think that is the excessive money they put in was never dragged back out. And as a matter of fact, when this guy first got in there, Paul, he started to drag some of the money out. Was it 2000? Was it 18? whatever it was, we had this whatever, we had, you know, pretty big sell-off in the market, and it was in Trump's first term, and he got called to the White House. I don't know if they paddled him or waterboarded him or whatever, and he came out, all of a sudden he started putting money back in the system. So clearly the people who are in control of this have an agenda that I think is hurting a lot of other people, but I don't think the other people got any power.
I don't think they do either, which is a shame, because these other people are people who actually matter.
Well, but even those people, though, probably, unlike 1929 and so forth, just about everybody's got some kind of a 401k or an IRA. So even your I don't want to use the term blue collar, but your ready every man worker realizes that the salary isn't covering stuff before, but the only firm leg to the stool is his 401k or his IRA. He doesn't want that going down either.
He doesn't.
So the reason why I think I knew you were coming on today, I didn't know if it was both of you or not. Did you read this thing about, came out 2 days ago, about people who work in the retail industry, which is a big industry? Average, their median income is $34,000 to $36,000.
I have not read that, but that's tough.
Yeah, well, they say now you need $71,000 to rent a typical apartment. They're not even, they're like less than like halfway there. That's pretty scary.
It is scary. That's tough. And I'd be curious to see what the breakdown of gender is for retail jobs. I remember this was when I first had my children. The rule of thumb is if you are making less than $50,000 a year, you're better off staying at home because of the cost of daycare.
Yeah, well, I would say that's probably true.
So, and again, this was almost 10 years ago. I would imagine it's daycare prices have skyrocketed. So if somebody's making $34,000, $36,000 a year, and if they're going to have children, they're sunk.
What it means is a mom's worth $50,000 a year, which is probably true.
Well, I think they're worth more than that.
Well, I'm saying at the very least, yeah. I mean,
right. Perhaps I'm a little biased, but
well, yeah. But I'm saying it's but even in dollars and cents, not just in everybody loves moms. Mm-hmm. Even in dollars and cents, the numbers. I mean, the ladies who used to work. This is in the '90s, Larissa. I was chairman of the marketing committee of the SIBO for about 3 years. For my last 3 years, I was on the board, and they had three or four ladies that worked there. Boy, talk about, you know, they were terrific. And one of the ladies, I'm going to say she was making, you know, I never checked, I never looked, never none of my business, but I'm going to guess 70, maybe 65, 70. And she had one or two kids. And she said, between the fact that you have a train ticket, you got to look nice, you got about nice outfits every day. And she goes, I'm netting about 15 a year. And then plus they would have to travel sometimes for a whole weekend to go to a seminar somewhere, which means, I guess hubby could take care of things for the weekend maybe, but he said sometimes you had the people there more than 8 hours a day. It wasn't like a regular job because sometimes sure. They had stuff at night, things like that, which, you know, is kind of a big deal on your partner too, because he might have places he has to go business too. Or it could be the other way around. It could be the guy and the lady. But it's not a zero-sum game at all, is it? Plus now you got to pay people Social Security and everything else. So it's I'd say the number there's got to be at least 50, isn't it?
Again, that was the rule of thumb 10 years ago. So,
yeah,
but that gets back to your original point, is you've got these two groups of people who are going through the economy, and we've got one group of people who are one car pair away from financial dire straits, and another group of people who can, you know, buy those cars that they want, pay cash for them. So it becomes a real challenge for how do you address these things for the overall economy, particularly when you're looking at the aggregate numbers of being almost telling a very pretty picture, like a very picture that the economy is doing well and that most people are doing financially well. When if you start to look at different segments of the economy, that's very different.
Well, if you're just if you're just rich, you have a you have a different view. I mean, if you made your money the old-fashioned way, you inherited it, right? You have a different view than if you own a business, and you're selling something or you're investing. I'm a money manager. I think overall health, and by the way, if you sold whatever you sold, baseball mitts, whatever it was, you'd probably be better off if 5,000 people can afford a bass boat rather than a guy like Michael Dell, you know, having some yacht that's 500 feet long and costs more than all the bass boats. I mean, the rest of us would probably be way better off if everybody had a little bit than a few people had a lot.
Right.
Because I don't think Michael Dell's going to come in my saloon. You probably would. But people who somehow seem to get their money, as a gross generalization, seem to somehow, a lot of people don't feel that way. As long as they have some, everything's fine. But if you're not making, I mean, you could be rich because you run a really nice business and you've made money over a period of time because you've earned it. That's one kind of rich, where you realize that if all of a sudden nobody walks in your door anymore to buy whatever it is you're selling, you got a problem. Versus, I don't have any business. I just got money in the bank and go get some. I mean, I think there's a difference in the mentality there. I don't know how you would write that down in a book, but there sure seems to be. And for me, I care about an awful lot of people walking in here and open up an account. You know, nice people. But I guess I could hope that Michael Dale walks in someday and hands me $1 billion to manage, but I guess I could wait a long time for that, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And again, I think this really highlights then the economic disparity in our nation. And we've seen, you know, other societies collapse because of this. You can't have this kind of system. We really do need the three different economic classes to really support what we're doing as an overall economy.
Well, why don't we have for a quick break? We come back, because I have a piece of paper here that I can tell from memory how it really wasn't always this way. And I just kind of want to get your view on kind of where we're heading and is it ever going to change? S&P Futures up 17, NASDAQ Futures up 48. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com, and it's PTISecurities.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right now.
right now. We're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Allen, Jimmy on the board. SP Futures up 17. NASDAQ Futures up 49. We got a couple of headlines coming flying by here. ADP number down 32,000. Yikes, it was supposed to be up 5,000. That's the first down on ADP for a while, I think. So that's not good. I'm going to say not good at all. Real quick around the rest of the world, there wasn't much going on in Europe. DAX up 40.2%, FTSE down 12, call that flat. Kick around up 1, call that flat. Big news seems to be oil. Well, oil is not a big news. Up 77 cents, but still 59.41, so not much going on there. Gold up 31 bucks to 42.52. Silver up 66 cents, 59.37. The big news here, and we'll discuss this, with not the big news today, but dollars had the ninth straight loss. So the euro is back up to almost the 117, and the pound to 133. The euro was under 116, and the British pound was 129. Now it's 133. So, Russell, what do you make of this the jobs dropping here? I guess what's the fix? Is there some sort of a fix here? Not a fix. I mean, we have a new, evidently this guy who's the economic advisor guy. I can't stand the guy. But anyway, he's going to be a new Fed chairman with the marching orders to drop the rates way down, which impacts, there's going to be a million talking heads on TV talking about it helps everybody and your credit card rates are going to go down. I'm going to say none of that will happen, except for people who are able to borrow at much less. And again, we talked a little bit about, I mean, Hal Snar actually coming up with the conclusions on all these capital requirements, that it's so much better now for a bank to give one loan for $100 million than 100 loans for $1 million, that it's scary. If we didn't have small banks around, not all parts of the country do, that you really would have no ability for a small business to get any kind of loans. And it seems like it's all kind of coming together kind of the wrong way. But first of all, what do you make of this ADP report?
Down 32. Oh, that's scary.
Yeah.
Hey, that was my first reaction when you said that. I thought, oh, no, that's really bad. I'd be very curious of what types of jobs. I've not looked deep into the report, if it can give that kind of information.
Headline says, led by steep small business job cuts.
Ooh, that's scary.
Yeah.
This gets back to one of your soapbox points is if small businesses aren't running, if they can't get loans, if they can't make things happen, we're losing a very valuable area of the workforce. And that's really scary, or at least it is to me, because these people, I don't believe, are going to be able to quickly rebound.
No, and the whole idea of this tariff fiasco is going to make these places grow because stuff's coming back here. It don't look like it's happening, does it?
No, it doesn't.
You mentioned the other comment, you asked a question regarding how are these jobs. Now, we haven't had a jobs report in a while. We're supposed to get one on the 16th, right? Well, Carl usually goes through these, and for the last really couple of years, the standout hiring spot has been in healthcare, but not in doctors and nurses. It's in the overhead of healthcare. There's no opinion on that other than to lob one out there and say, I'm not sure that's where you want it.
No, I don't think it is either. Once you start to get too top heavy, these organizations become too difficult to sustain. And eventually there will be a correction in that, which again then leaves quite a few people unemployed, and they might be unemployed with not as well transferable skills. Because if it's the entire industry being corrected, they're going to have to move to other industries in administration roles.
How does Purdue handle hospitalization for the students? Are we just still on their parents' coverage?
I don't know this. I can speak very superficially around it. I know that you can get, or at least, let me rephrase that. I can talk about when I was a grad student at Illinois Institute of Technology. And as a grad student, so I was over 24 and very much on my own, as a grad student, I got my own insurance through the university. And I had worked in the industry, or I worked in the financial markets for quite some time. And I think I paid $800 for the calendar year for my insurance. And I thought, because I remember how much insurance cost before, I thought it was a steal.
Oh, yeah.
I was thrilled. And I, as a grad student, I was able to purchase my own insurance directly through the university, and what I would consider to be a deep discount. I think most of our undergraduate students are still under their parents' insurance, because I think parents can carry them until they're 24.
I thought it was 24 or 26. You're probably right.
It might be 26. I don't. My children aren't old enough, and all of those reforms happened after I had aged out quite some time. So I think I stayed on my parents' insurance until I was 22 and when I graduated from college.
I think it was 21 in my day. And when I went to grad school at University of Chicago, it was included in the tuition.
Okay.
But I don't recall the gap between being 21 and going to the University of Chicago. There had to be at least a year there, and I don't know what got so long ago. I don't remember what happened, but the insurance costs were so cheap. Like when I went into the trading floor, I became a market maker. First options picked up my insurance, even before I even made trade one. And then by 6 months into it, I hired a clerk who had a family. I think I was paying $75 a month for him and his whole family. It was like a Blue Cross Cadillac policy. Obviously, that ship has sailed.
Well, it's definitely sailed.
Yeah, I mean, now it's but I wonder what, if we were going to chart a course here, we don't want the market to crash, even though I think it's too high. I'd like to see the economy grow into it. Carl thinks I'm nuts with that. There's no way that's going to happen. It's too high. I'm hoping he's wrong and I could be right. But I mean, I think we need a 2 or 3 or 4% gain in real wages. Operative word there being real, for the next 2 or 3 years, and we might be able to avoid some kind of a calamity. He thinks there's zero chance of that. What do you think? Is it possible?
I think based on today's jobs reports, it's quite alarming, and it doesn't support the hypothesis that we could have those real gains. I think it's indicating quite the opposite. Because let me be frank with you, I want you to be right. I do not want the economy to collapse. It's the economy collapsing is bad for everybody. But if we don't see real gains, and we don't see in real wage gains, so that people can afford basic necessities like healthcare, we're going to be in a situation where we're going to continue to slow and continue to contract.
Well, I mean, we have so many. What's the average car in the street now? How old is he? Why didn't we all get together 5 years ago and buy like 3 or 4 auto repair facilities?
No kidding.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, now I don't know of anybody. I mean, there's a few people who've gone out and bought new cars that I know, but everybody's driving some old junker and can't seem to get them in to get fixed. It's like a 2 week wait to get the thing fixed. It's unbelievable. I mean, at some point, these things are going to fall apart unless we're going to. You ever see the movie Havana? The people driving the cars from the 50s? I don't know what was powering them, but they somehow were moving. Is that our future or what?
Well, and it's funny you should say that. I actually think the cars from the 50s and 60s were better built.
Well, they were heavier.
They were very heavier. But those parts were built more to last. I feel like the parts that we have now in our cars are not as durable. My dad has a 1967 Corvette.
Wow.
And that thing runs fine.
He's probably still got a carburetor in that thing.
Yeah, it's a very different mechanism for these types of cars, and they're more, I don't want to say easily fixable, but you can get in there and actually do a lot of work to fix your cars. And when my dad was growing up, that's what he did. He didn't take cars to a car repair shop. He figured out how to fix it himself because he didn't have any money to do it. Even if you have the ingenuity and the technical, you know, the mechanical abilities, because everything's so much more electronic in your car, it's a lot different to try to fix it on your own.
Well, you can't.
You can't.
Yeah. But you don't, I have a nostalgic view of those eras. If it's cold outside, you can't give me a carburetor. We're so used to fuel injection. You turn it on and it goes. Every morning you got to be careful with the choke, and if you screwed it up, you got to wait a while. And,
sure.
I was a janitor for the Board of Education, and one winter, God's sake, Lewis, the place I had was in this terrible neighborhood, and I had to be there at like 5:40 or something, and I was key personnel. I'm a kid in college, and they give me I was the one who took off the burglar alarm and everything on the place, so nobody else could get in. So I'm showing up in this crummy neighborhood at 5:30 in the morning. The guy who did the fireman, when I say the fireman, the real fireman, it was a coal operated facility. Can you imagine that? So the guy already had the coal fire going, and he had to get steam up for the engineer to come in to turn all the pumps and stuff on. And I'm going out in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. and starting the damn thing just to make sure it would start. I mean,
sure.
I mean, you don't have today. You don't have to do that. So
it's, no, you don't.
you got to be a little careful about how nostalgic you get on these things.
Well, I do like the Corvette. Let me be very candid. I like it quite a bit, but it does not have heated seats. It does.
You're lucky
not
if it has heat.
Yeah, it does have heat. It's so there are some technology that I appreciate. But it's a lot easier still to get in there and try to fix it.
Well, the other day my girlfriend hops in my pickup and she turns. She goes, "How come your heated seat's not on?" I go, "I don't even know I had a heated seat." Why would I thought of. So what if we had a, you know, if we could ever get both sides of the aisle together and identify some of these problems, what do you think? What's the first fix? If there was five things we were going to do, what are we going to do? I think one of them, just because of the numbers. By the way, I don't know if you saw it. I don't want to ruin your day. You see last month's fiscal number from the government?
I have not.
$540 billion in the hole, the biggest monthly in the hole ever.
That's tough.
That's the first month of the new year. So that's... You know, that's with a guy who's telling us how much he saved with Doge and all that other kind of crap that he hasn't saved anything at. Or he might have saved a little bit somewhere. But the biggest chunk of this is medical care.
You know, yes, it is.
We have a lady listener who sent me a letter, or not a letter, but a text, not a text, an email a while ago, saying she was taking care of somebody with cancer, and I don't think it's going too well, but I haven't heard in months. But anyway, the thought was, since the person didn't have any insurance, of taking the person maybe to another country to get the chemo. So I sit there, and I was bored for 2 minutes, and market was boring, so I kick up chemo prices in other countries. And they put up with a comparison that in this country, some chemo treatments now, the new ones, $15,000 to $50,000 per treatment. Pretty much the same stuff in India, $500 to $2,000.
Oh my goodness.
Whether you want to go to India or don't, or you're going to complain about whether it's not as sterile over whatever you want to complain about, I don't see how we continue to do that and stay solvent. I mean, the numbers are too big. If it was twice or three times, you know, I think we're big enough to handle that. I don't see the amount of cancers around. I don't see everybody having a half a million or $1 million course of treatment and how we can afford that, especially if other people seem to do the same thing for $100,000. I mean, there's stuff here that sort of seems to have to get fixed, and I don't see anything moving in that direction, do you?
No, I don't. And what's also concerning about this, and this is something we talked about last time, is this idea that there are now strategies to reduce your income and your assets so that you are more, you can get more Medicaid benefits so that you're not paying for some of those cancer treatments out of pocket as you reach a retirement age. I find it concerning that these are genuine strategies being put out there as ways to, I don't want to say manipulate the system, but to maximize your benefits within the system, that people are essentially trying to get rid of assets so that they can, I don't want to say claim poverty, but they can maximize their Medicaid benefits. And this is now considered a legitimate strategy for financial planners. Well, and that has been concerned.
But you, by the way, I'm absolutely talking to the expert here. The number used to be, if you went, which COVID sort of made happen with the inflation, if your salary went from $42,000 to $52,000 and you were buying your own insurance from Obamacare, did you gain anything? I don't think you did. I think you lost, didn't you?
I think so.
So I guess if you're a shrewd person who has a family, people you care about, people let their own insurance go before they let somebody else's go.
Right.
I would do everything in my power to somehow find a way to still be at $42,000 and maybe get more vacation, get paid cash, although I'm not going to recommend anybody do anything illegal. Why do I need that other $10,000? You're not doing me any favors.
Well, I do have some friends who have, because of children, have been able to not manipulate, but structure their lives so that they're within the Medicaid system because of their kids. And they can do it by making sure that, to your point, that they don't go for that higher salary. Like, they're better off staying exactly where they are so that they're not changing their prices. And that's something wrong. Right? This is not good for the economy because we're not expanding the economy that way. We're really taking a subset of people who are now focusing on staying in this tiny spot so that they don't hit these exorbitant costs for healthcare. So I think healthcare reform for costs and insurance and the way Medicare works and Medicaid work, it has to be reformed because, and to your point earlier about if we are hiring more people in administrative roles, we're just creating a bigger and bigger overhead, which is going to be absorbed in the cost through insurance and through these high prices and premiums that people are paying.
I doubt if you remember, but when I was real young, you went to the doctor, you paid, and if the insurance covered you, the insurance reimbursed you. So there's no two doctors and 15 people playing patty cake with the insurance companies in a normal doctor's office.
Sure.
I just, you know what's funny, and with all the, you know, amazingly intelligent people we have in this country, a lot of them teaching, a lot of them learning, why is it when you bring up a question of like, and I'm not accusing you of doing it because you didn't. When somebody says, well, gee, this treatment costs $40,000, and then we all scurry around, okay, this guy's going to cut back on his income so he can be involved in Medicaid and they'll pay for it, or somebody else is going to get a job that has a good insurance and they pay for it, or something along the line, instead of saying, wait a minute, the $40,000, if we have to send Russell in his cardigan down to the Amazon to wrestle an alligator and pull out his wisdom tooth to get what we need for that treatment, it actually does cost $40,000. They don't have any problem with it. But if the guys are pumping it out at $3,000 and they're charging $40,000, I don't see how in all my education, anybody, Houdini, Solomon, you name it, Jesus Christ, can come up with a system where somehow or another we cover $40,000 when it should be $3,000. I don't care what you do with it. You can take the shell game on the sidewalk. It's too friggin' high. I mean, people are going to do whatever you're describing. They're going to find a way to get somebody else to somehow help them with it. The fact is, at the end of the day, there is no good right way. It's just too expensive.
Well, and the reason why it's too expensive is because we have all this additional overhead.
Well, it could be because we have a patent when we shouldn't.
Right, but that's part of the overhead.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would not so sure. Now that you mention it, yeah, it is.
It's part of the overhead.
Yeah, boy, now that you mention it.
We have huge overheads for healthcare costs. And so it really doesn't necessarily, the price that you're looking at, that $40,000, isn't really truly just the treatment and the medication and the time for the doctors and the nurses and the usage of the hospital room, right? It's all of those other things. It's those patents. It's that the administration, it's so much more that goes into it. And all of those costs are then pushed down to the end users. And it's a unique way where when Medicaid negotiates with a hospital, it's negotiating on behalf of this conglomerate of people, as opposed to really looking for the best deal, because now the hospital's negotiating and saying, okay, well, this is our overhead. We need to make sure we cover all of these things. The hospital isn't going through, or the pharmacy or whatever medical healthcare provider isn't really thinking about how can we reduce costs, you know, and part of it could be the patents, and part of it could be just administrators, but there are ways that could be reducing costs, and we're not focused on those. We're focused on covering those costs as opposed to reducing those. So we're not looking for better technology to reduce costs. We're simply looking to actually increase those costs so that we can generate more revenue for the medical provider.
Well, the people that make the zillions of dollars working in these hospitals, they think they're worth it. It's not like they're the doctors. Do you ever think in your lifetime that the doctor would no longer be the highest paid person in the system?
That's funny. I didn't really think about it, but I see your point.
Give me a story. We talked earlier about these coaches. And a lot of the coaches now are making all this dough. And his buddy, you'll love this guy. I think Russell knows what I'm talking about. Notre Damer, which doesn't say much for Notre Damers. His family, very, very entrenched in there. His brother, a quarterback, who was a Super Bowl ring, national championship ring. So anyway, I see this guy, Beldo, I'll call him. That's his name. I said, Beldo, you know that in 45 states of the union, the highest paid person in the state is either the football coach or the basketball coach. And I thought that was absolutely incredible, because since you would think it would be the chief of surgery or something at the hospital, right, or the governor. And he goes, he looks at me and he goes, Tommy, seriously, who the hell would want to live in any of those other five states?
That's funny.
So we don't all think alike, do we?
No.
So what I don't see how. It seems like it's getting worse. You get more and more combinations of hospitals seemingly every day. One gets taken over, the prices get raised. I mean, it's you know, it's the Sherman Act, like we tabled that, or the Clayton Act. One of the thing that kind of got me on this is we had a terrific young lady on the show, and she did some research for a couple of universities, and now she's I think she's going to Yale or Northwestern for a PA thing. Anyway, and she was saying how she worked at the place, and if you and I donated a bunch of money for a disease and the research is going on in there, and maybe the doctor or the person doing the research manages to get a grant from government, and all of a sudden maybe we cure something, you know, or we get something that's a really good cure of some kind, well, the universities or the place you do it drop a huge overhead on top of the money that's raised for people doing the stuff in their facility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are allegedly nonprofits, right? Okay, so they're going to drop this. And the weird part is, if we come up with a cure, I mean, a cure is a long-term, or treatment, I'll say, better, the young lady who was in here doing the work, she's not getting a piece of it. The doctor's probably not getting a piece of it. You and I, who ponied up the $1 million for the research, we're not getting a piece of it. All of a sudden, some drunk company swoops in and maybe the university gets a little, you know, get to wet their beak a little bit. Somebody else walks away with the patent. And none of the people who are involved, and all of a sudden for the next 17 years, somebody gets to gouge the crap out of people. I have an issue with that. I don't know how you change that either, though, do you?
Well, part of it is the law structuring around some of these patents. So one thing that could be evaluated is whether or not 17 years is really reasonable, because the idea behind the 17-year patent is that it's supposed to cover the high cost of testing all of these drugs. And the 17 years is not only to cover the cost of testing that particular drug, but all the other drugs that failed. So if you've got 20 research projects and only one succeeds, the drug manufacturer needs to be able to cover the costs of those other 19, which is one of the reasons why you have such a large patent or a long patent law protecting those, that asset, and protecting those future cash flow streams. So one thing that could be done is looking at whether or not this is reasonable. Is this really enough to cover all of those failed drug experiments? What? Should we have tighter rules about what drugs that we're testing?
We don't.
Should we go ahead? Sorry.
So we don't cover you for writing up a course curriculum that the university says no to.
No, correct.
Why is it even a? You got to pay me a huge salary for all the times I strike out? I mean, well, come on. Why are the only industry gets to do that?
That is a question that should be evaluated and looked at, and that's at least a starting place for potentially reducing some of the overall overhead costs for healthcare.
Out of the last, this is just an opinion on both of our parts. Out of the last 15 serious drugs that Pfizer's put on the market, how many of you think they developed versus they found somebody else developing and bought the place?
Well, I have no idea, but that's an interesting question.
I'm gonna bet at least 50-50.
Yeah, but that's an interesting point.
Yeah, so we gotta pay them to do research around the world for anybody doing anything, so they can buy them up.
And that's similar to the issues that we have in technology, right? So if a startup is really good, it's Google buys it, right?
Yeah, so, We don't have no stinking antitrust laws, do we?
Right.
What would you do tomorrow? God, I would. You don't want me there. Would you tomorrow if you asked your class, any people ever heard of the Sherman or Clayton Act? Would anybody even know what they are?
I doubt it.
That's scary, isn't it?
It is. And again, these are topics that are hopefully covered in freshman level econ, but I have no idea.
Wow. So are you guys? What's your schedule for the? The holidays. How many days are you guys off down there? Or maybe we'll see. Get to see you guys.
Maybe you will. We are, or at least Purdue. We have classes this week, and then we have quiet week next week, and then the week after that is finals.
Oh, what is quiet week?
You know, I'm still learning what quiet week is all about. So classes continue. And it's supposed to be a period where students aren't slammed with a bunch of exams or projects, because a lot of times the week before finals, professors will give a lot of material that during that time period. So this is designed to help relieve students of those extra burdens.
But if we went out to the local bar, could we still talk loud and play the music?
Oh, I believe so.
All right, well, then not so bad, eh?
It's not so bad.
talk about two differences at University of Chicago versus Notre Dame in terms of finals. Notre Dame was really big on, if you had two classes in a row on, like, say, a Monday morning, they would schedule finals such a way where the 8 o'clock class might be at 8 o'clock, but the 9 o'clock class could be, like, on Tuesday night or something.
Right.
So they tried to spread them all out so you'd have some chance. University of Chicago, if you had three in a row, you had three in a row finals, which was a whole different. You really had to talk about prioritize. You had to sit there and go, all right, well, I kind of know what the guy's talking about in this class, so I won't study that one, but this one, you know, we're talking about time management. I don't know which was better, but it was sure different.
It is.
Well, how do you guys do it? Do you have them right in a row, or do you spread them out?
Oh, no, we're much more like Notre Dame.
Yeah, I think that makes more sense, actually. But any...
And you got to remember also, these are undergraduate students. It's a little bit different when you're talking about 18 to 22-year-olds.
Yeah, well, that's true. Anyway, good to hear you.
Thank you so
much. Want to see you soon and say hello to Russell. Is he, where is he, lecturing in China or someplace? What's he doing?
You know, I'm not entirely sure.
He's always somewhere, that guy. Anyway, S&P Futures up 2, NASDAQ Futures down 30, so we've turned around here a little bit. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.